This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's the second most traded commodity in the world, with 15 billion pounds shipped every year. Coffee is a major part of our worldwide economy and our culture. As many as 75 million people in more than 50 countries are involved in growing and producing coffee today. But how much do we really know about it and where it comes from? How does it impact our environment? And how can we become better consumers? Coffee, The World in Your Cup, an exhibit started in Seattle and currently at the Peabody Museum in New Haven, made us wonder about our coffee footprint. Today in Where We Live, we've assembled coffee experts, the coordinator of the exhibit in Seattle, two local micro-roasters, and the founder of a coffee distribution company that contributes a percentage of its proceeds to support sustainable coffee production and trade. They'll answer questions about the history, the present, and the future of this ubiquitous commodity. Are we becoming a more caffeinated society? What kind of coffee do you drink every day? Would you admit to being a coffee snob, or are all brews created equal? We'll also be asking about fair trade. All these questions are up for grabs. Join us at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive, and we'd like to hear about your favorite local coffee shop as well. First, we're going to go out to Seattle. Ruth Pelz was exhibit coordinator of the original coffee exhibit that's now at the Peabody Museum at Yale in New Haven. She started this at the Burke Museum of Natural History in Seattle, Washington. She woke up bright and early in Seattle to join us on the phone. Ruth, thanks for being here on Where We Live.
Okay.
Well, you said you just made a cup of coffee to wake up. I have to ask, what did you brew?
I brewed an Ethiopian. One of the joys of working on the exhibit was getting a chance to try coffees from many, many different roasters in many parts of the world. And you may not know that coffee has more aromatic chemicals than wine. So the variety is really terrific, and it was fun to try them all.
Hold it. More aromatic chemicals than wine? Tell us about that.
Well, they're released in the roasting process, and it just gives a huge variety. You might find a coffee that tastes really like the berries that it comes from, or you might find a coffee that's roasted so dark that all you taste is the roast. But there's a huge variety and very complicated chemistry that I won't pretend to have mastered when I was putting the exhibit together.
Now, obviously, it's kind of a cliche, right? We reached you out in Seattle. It's the coffee mecca of the United States. But
yeah.
What inspired you to make an exhibit out of this? What inspired you to pull this coffee exhibit together?
Well, it's a great story, actually, and it went back almost 15 years when a scientist from the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center came to our University of Washington campus and presented his research. He'd been down in Central America, and he found that the bird diversity on traditional shade-grown coffee plantations was almost as high as in the native forests. But in the new strain of sun-grown coffee that was grown where the land was deforested, the bird diversity plummeted, and it was linked to the decline in migratory birds that were returning each year to our own backyards. And I heard that, and I said, the Natural History Museum in Seattle has to do something about this sometime. And the idea kind of sat there for a while until the fair trade movement got so big on our campus and other campuses in the Seattle area. And then the need seemed to be more urgent, and I put a proposal together and gave it to our exhibits committee, and our staff at the museum was very enthusiastic about it, and that's how it began.
And the exhibit brings together not only this story of migratory bird species, but the entire history and culture of coffee. How do all these things tie together? Because it is a more complex story than I think many people who don't know would give it credit for.
Really, it was even more complex than we imagined, because we're a museum of the environment and culture, and those were the issues that inspired us. But once I got looking into it, everything about coffee was interesting. The history is interesting, the agriculture is interesting, and so is the processing that takes place on our end. One thing that most people don't know, for example, is that the coffee beans we drink are actually two seeds inside a little cherry-like fruit. And the history of coffee, one thing that we mostly don't know, is that it was called a revolutionary drink. Because coffee, from the earliest history of coffee shops, they brought together people from different backgrounds and ways of life who might never have met each other and stimulated talk. And ultimately, that led to a kind of questioning of the status quo, and that's where it got its revolutionary reputation.
This coffee store culture is something that is certainly in evidence out in the Pacific Northwest, in places around here in New England, but coffee's become more ubiquitous than that. It's not just something that we gather around and drink a really good specialty brew, but we wait in line at Dunkin' Donuts, we grab one on the way out the door. How did it become this thing that everyone seems to need to have in the morning, no matter if they're a revolutionary or just sort of a guy going to work?
Well, it's funny, if you go back in the history, it just caught on like crazy everywhere it went. Really fast. It spread across Europe so quickly, and there are some wonderful quotes from the history. You know, the French king is complaining that people are disregarding their good French wine, and in Germany they're saying nobody drinks German beer anymore. It just had an instant appeal, and I think we have the same appeal today. You know, it's stimulating without being alcoholic, and that made a wonderful improvement as it swept across Europe in the several hundred years ago, when water wasn't safe to drink, but beer was, or wine was, and you read stories of English clerks drinking beer all day long until by the end of the day they weren't thinking very well, and coffee was a huge improvement for them, and I think it wakes us up, makes us feel good even today.
Ruth Pals is exhibit coordinator for the original coffee exhibit at the Burke Museum of Natural History in Seattle, Washington. That exhibit, called Coffee, the World in Your Cup, has made its way to New Haven at the Peabody Museum at Yale, and it's on display now. You can join us at 860-275-7266 if you have questions or ideas, thoughts about coffee and how it affects your life, maybe even your favorite coffee store in and around Connecticut. 860-275-7266. You can email wherelive@wnpr.org. We're going to be talking a bit later on about the fair trade movement, but obviously, Ruth Pels, there are some stories behind the production of coffee that aren't entirely too pleasant. As you put this together, what did you learn about the way that coffee is grown and harvested and the people who actually do that work?
Okay, well, one thing about coffee is that made it so appealing for our exhibit is it's something that makes direct connections. It connects the richest countries and the poorest countries around the world. It connects us in our daily lives to people and environments that we may not be aware of. It's a really good window on how our consumer choices affect the world. And so coffee is produced in many countries, most of them among the world's poorest, and of course the biggest consuming countries are among the richest. And I don't know, do you want me to launch into some stories about how it's produced and the different ways that affect our taste, or just where would you like to go with this?
Well, launch into a story, if you would, and perhaps about how exactly it is grown and how it gets to our coffee pot in the morning, because I think one thing, Ruth, is people don't really understand exactly where coffee comes from. I didn't know that it was two little seeds inside a little cherry-like fruit. I had no idea. I just drink about a pot of coffee every morning. So where does it come from exactly?
Well, it likes a climate that's not too hot and not too cold and moderately wet, and that pretty much takes in a belt around the tropics around the world. Not too hot, but generally at a higher elevation, so that the flavor develops slowly. That'll give you better flavor. Now, the coffee plant is related to gardenias. That's one thing. It's the smell of the flowers when they're in bloom is just wonderful. It takes about 3 to 4 years to begin producing, so it's an investment for a farmer to put it in. And then it can have ripe berries and flowers and unripe berries on the same stem. So to get the very best quality, first of all, it's got to be grown in the right kind of place. And then it has to be harvested selectively when each berry is fully ripe. And then think about any fruit that you buy at the store. Once you pick it, it starts to go bad. And so there's a challenge of getting those beans out of the fruit and processed as fast as you can, so that it doesn't pick up any flavors of bad fruit. And as I go through this story, just think about all of these many steps, and each step is part of the difference of a low-quality supermarket coffee and that really great coffee that you stand in line at a specialty coffee store to buy. Once you get the beans out, which is done by running them, well, there's two ways to process it. One is to take the fresh fruit and you run it through a depulping machine. It's kind of a rough machine that pulls most of the fruit out, and then the fruit is put in a vat and allowed to ferment, and then the rest of the it's in a vat of water. Then the pulp can be washed away, and the beans are put out to dry. The other processing method, which is the oldest method and is not so common anymore in high-quality coffees, is dry process, where the beans are just dried quickly. And this can happen in a country that's got a hot climate but not very much water. So many of the African coffees could be dry processed. So it's like making a raisin. The fruit dries on the bean, and you get a lot more of that fruit flavor concentrated in the bean. And then the dried pulp is pulled off afterwards. So now you've got the beans out on a drying rack or a drying patio, and they're being somebody's out there turning them over every day so that they dry evenly and you don't get any rot in there. And then they're packaged up in bags and sent to a warehouse. And those bags, we had one of the bags in our exhibit that you could try lifting if you want, because all the videos show these guys just hefting them up and throwing them on the truck or the container or whatever.
But these are really, really heavy.
They're really heavy.
Yeah.
I could just budge the corner of it. That's all. So then it lands on our side, and the processing begins. And as I said, those chemicals are released in the roasting process. And I think you should talk to your experts there about everything that goes on the roasting
side.
Well,
as a matter of fact, when we come back from our break, that's what we're going to do. Barry Levine is the founder of co-founder of Willoughby's in New Haven. It's one of the great coffee stores in our area. So he'll pick up the story from the roasting process. But I want to thank you, Ruth Pels, who coordinated the exhibit for this coffee exhibit that was originally at the Burke Museum of Natural History in Seattle, and now it makes its way to the Peabody Museum in New Haven. It's called Coffee, the World in Your Cup. More information on our website, WNPR.org, keyword where. Thanks so much, Ruth, for being here. I appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome.
Hey, join the conversation, 860-275-7266. What do you want to know about coffee? What's your favorite cup? 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. With more than 500 billion cups served worldwide each year, it's the most popular beverage in the world. After water, of course, we're talking about coffee on the program today. You can join us at 860-275-7266. Email us wherewelive at WNPR.org, or put down your cup of coffee and tweet us at Where We Live. We're joined from Yale University Studios in New Haven by Barry Levine. He is the co-founder of the local specialty coffee store Willoughby's. It goes all the way back to 1985, before this big boom of specialty coffee happened around the world. He's part of this exhibit that's happening at the Peabody Museum we're talking about today, Coffee, the World in Your Cup, that's happening down in New Haven. Barry Levine, thanks so much for joining us here on Where We Live.
Good morning, John.
So very quickly, now Ruth Pels, who was out in Seattle, who helped put this exhibit together, got us all the way from growing the coffee beans and taking them across the ocean to the place where these big bags land on our shores. Okay, what happens next on the roaster's end? What do you do with these coffee beans to make them into a delicious beverage for us?
Well, Willoughby's is first and foremost a coffee roaster. And by the way, Ruth did an excellent job of a fundamental description of how coffee is grown and processed. We take the coffee when it comes in, and we receive it in those very heavy sacks that you described, which are coffee's typically measured in bags, and a bag is 60 kilos or about 132 pounds. We take the coffee, and it goes into one of two coffee roasting machines that we have, and we heat the coffee as it moves around a rotating drum. The application of heat, when we apply the heat, the ramping up of the temperature, and essentially how we cook the coffee is an artisanal process. And we've been working at that for quite a long time to try to get it as perfect as we can be. And then we roast to one of several levels of darkness. we roast coffee to what's called a full city level, which is a fully brown developed bean in which the flavors are maximized. The brightness of the coffee exists as well as body, and the flavors of the coffee itself come through. When you roast coffee to a darker level, a style that's popular on the West Coast predominantly, and in several chains that we are familiar with, the darker roasted coffee it has a dominant flavor of the roast itself, and we lose a little bit of the individuality of the coffee in the process.
Well, and that's what Ruth was saying before, is sometimes you taste the roast more than the coffee. I want to get to Christina. She's talking about, Christina's calling from Hartford and is talking about one of those specialty stores from the West Coast. We might have heard of it before. Hi, Christina. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I just heard you talking about coffee, and I'm like, you know, this is the one time I absolutely have to make sure I call in. I love coffee.
Well, what do you love about coffee? Tell us.
I enjoy the taste. I have tried to quit drinking coffee, and it's not even the caffeine. I enjoy the taste of it every morning, and I'm very, very crotchety without it.
Now, there's the I'm very crotchety without it. That's the little buzz that people get, the pick-me-up. Do you ever view this, and I can say this because I do too, Christina, maybe view it a little bit as a crutch, like I just can't get going unless I have a couple of cups of coffee?
No, I think it's more of a, I crave the flavor of it. Just, you know, a good cup of coffee that's brewed right, put the right amount in, you fixed it just right, and it's the best start to a day.
Now, I got to ask you, where do you get your coffee, Christina?
Well, there are a few blends at Whole Foods I enjoy. Unfortunately, the best shop I've found so far around here is Starbucks. I hate and love to say. My favorite blend of theirs, though, is the Gazebo blend. It's a seasonal blend, which it might be gone by now. I'm not really sure. But I kind of like the light to medium-bodied blends myself.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it, Christina. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And this is Where We Live. We're talking coffee today. You can join us 860-275-7266. So Barry Levine, down at Yale in New Haven, you founded Willoughby's back in 1985. Starbucks sort of took over the world, it seems. But, you know, for as much as we talk about Starbucks being on every street corner, it's about 2% of the global harvest. It's not really ubiquitous. What has changed about Starbucks? What's the good and the bad for the local coffee roaster about having this big monolithic company that everyone seems to know about and people seem to like their product?
Well, when Starbucks opens in an area, I think it brings its nervousness for local roasters, but our experience has proven that the Starbucks really doesn't take away from our business, but the market in general expands. We've never been hurt by a presence of a nearby Starbucks. You know, we deal in different kinds of coffee, I might say. I mean, Willoughby's is really about quality. We try to source coffees of real distinction and character, and we're guided by the flavors of coffee, and we go after only the highest grades available and then try to roast them to maximize their flavor. While we provide, we try to provide enjoyable cafe experiences as well, and we also brew all of the coffees that we roast, the primary purpose of Willoughby's is that of a coffee roaster. Starbucks, I think, and they are very good at it, is about a cafe experience, the Starbucks experience, and they're very good at providing large, comfortable spaces for people to spend time in.
Well, one of the things we've heard from some people in your business, though, is that they credit Starbucks, because even though it makes them nervous whenever a Starbucks comes into the area, it has changed the way people view the experience of coffee. Christina called up and said, I just really like the taste of a good cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not always the way it was in America before Starbucks was every place. You just get kind of a crappy cup of coffee at the gas station on the way into work.
Well, you're right. When we started in business now 25 years ago, the main coffees around were instant coffee and supermarket canned coffee that Ruth addressed. And there are two main species of coffees, which are, one is called Arabica, which is original Arabian varietal, and we're familiar with that term, and the other one is called Robusta. And Robusta are coffees that grow at lower altitudes and are resistant to diseases and very much easier to grow. They're more productive, and the quality is much lower. When we entered business, Robusta was the dominant coffee that was being grown around the world. About two-thirds of the coffee at that time was Robusta. What we've seen over the period of our business life is that there's been a complete reversal in that, and the majority of production today is that of Arabica. And Arabica beans require much more work. They grow at high altitudes. They're prone to some disease. They're hard to pick. You have to pick them just when cherries are ripe. And there's much more labor that's involved with it, but the result is a superior cup.
We're talking with Barry Levine. He's a co-founder of Willoughby's Coffee and Tea down in New Haven all the way back in 1985. He speaks to us today from the Yale Studios in New Haven. Yale's Peabody Museum is hosting a new exhibit called Coffee, the World in Your Cup, that made its way from Seattle. There's more information on our website, WNPR.org, keyword where. Get to some of your phone calls now at 860-275-7266. Tim's in New Haven. Hi, Tim. You're on Where We Live.
Hey, John, thanks for taking the call.
Yeah, what's up?
I can't help wondering, when I hear about coffee growing at high altitude in the Andes, if there's a risk that global warming will push the regions, the coffee-growing regions, up the mountains and eventually destroy them. That I know that's happening with bird habitat in the tropics. So I wonder if any of your guests can answer that.
Well, you know what I might do, Tim, and thank you very much for your question. I might put that to David Griswold. David Griswold joins us on the phone from Portland, Oregon, founder and president of Sustainable Harvest. It's a coffee importing social enterprise with a mission to improve livelihoods of some of the farmers around the world who grow coffee for us. David Griswold, thank you very much for joining us on Where We Live.
Thanks for having me.
So I don't know if you heard Tim's question. Tim was asking about, is global warming affecting the coffee trade? What can you tell us about that?
Well, Tim's got a very astute question. It's affecting all agriculture worldwide, and certainly coffee is seeing the effects of climate change. And exactly what he was mentioning, that as coffee needs to be grown in cooler climates, as it was explained by the first speaker, it's in the belt of the tropics. It's at higher altitudes where higher portions of biodiversity occur, so there's an environmental question. But as you go up the mountain and it gets warmer, that you do eventually run out of land space. And so there have been some surveys done where scientists have seen that coffee will eventually run out of space. And it's difficult for farmers to move their farms. As anybody can imagine, it's hard to move your house. It's difficult to move your farms. And so it poses a problem. And of course, it's one of the things that people are concerned about as they see more of the earth warming.
David, maybe you can tell us about what exactly Sustainable Harvest is and what you do.
Well, I've been in coffee as a coffee importer for about 20 years, but I got in for different reasons than just being in business. As you mentioned, we're a social enterprise business, which means we're a triple bottom line. I was concerned about ways to help farmers in villages around the world improve their lives, but I thought coffee could be a great way to do that. So we're one of the largest importers of fair trade organic coffee in North America. And so that means we find coffee around the world. We buy it, we import it, and sell it to roasters like the roasters in the United States and other parts of the world. But then we use that money to finance the work to train growers how to access the market. So more than half of our resources go into farmer training centers around the world to help farmers learn how to produce their coffee in more environmental ways, so that they can, and also that improve their quality, so they can sell to these higher paying roaster clients like the ones that we've heard from.
I'm wondering, Barry Levine in New Haven at Willoughby's, maybe you can talk about what fair trade coffee means to you. This is certainly something that we've been hearing an awful lot about, and you can experience in some stores and others, they don't have any fair trade coffee. What exactly does that mean to you in your business?
Well, fair trade is one of several certifications that coffee can carry. Others are Rainforest Alliance, bird-friendly coffee, organic, and Starbucks has its own niche called Cafe Practices, and there are others as well. Fair trade assures farmers of slightly more income for their coffee, but fair trade only deals with cooperatives, meaning that you can't deal with individual farmers. Most of the coffee that we buy, we go out and we find. I mean, our objective is to try to find the very best coffee that we can get. I mean, that's what we're all about, and that takes us to a lot of individual farms and farming relationships. And farmers, individual farmers or states, whether they be small or large, cannot be participants in fair trade. So fair trade deals only with, and I believe there are about 300 cooperatives and its members. And then a fee is collected from roasters. After administration, some of that fee makes it back to the cooperative, and the cooperative distributes it to its members, either in the form of additional revenue or in benefits like education. And we do carry several fair trade coffees, but it's not the benchmark that we go seeking coffee based on.
David Griswold, maybe you can pick up on that and tell us what's real and what's not real about fair trade. Many of us who are consumers of, say, organic products have heard over the course of years sometimes organic means something that is very, very good, healthy, and sustainable, and sometimes it means something that's very, very big and corporate and is sort of a bit of a ruse. Is fair trade kind of the same sort of designation?
Well, I think what Barry was saying was accurate, that fair trade is about a minimum base price, a guaranteed minimum floor for farmers, and in low coffee markets, it guarantees that they make enough to cover their costs. But they do have to be organized into cooperatives, and that is one of the challenges, because if there's a plantation that wants to be called a fair trade farm, they actually have to look at other certification options like rainforest, as Barry mentioned. Fair trade uses the idea of that the democratic and transparent organization is the co-op, and they decide how to democratically invest their revenues. There's a plethora of seals, of third-party seals that have been developed around coffee, and it's very interesting to see that, and I think it shows that coffee is one of these flash-button or hot-button issues, because there's so many environmental and social issues that are in every cup of coffee that many, many groups, there's dozens of seals that have been created to say coffee is bird-friendly or organic or fair trade. And I think in the case of fair trade, it is the strong suit of a third-party certification is that you have an independent body going out to verify the claims that people are making. But there's also some new efforts in the coffee industry, and especially industry, for direct trade as well. And I think people may see that in some of the stores where the roasters are certifying the work that they're doing by telling the story, and don't necessarily have a third party verifying it, but they are doing so much travel that they want to tell that story, and it's that you'll see a little bit of that happening.
Right. Barry Levine?
We're involved in direct trade on a number of coffees, I think about four or five of them at the moment, and we often do travel to origin, and you know what we're seeking, not only are coffees of distinction, but when a farmer is able to produce something that then gets recognized as a superior product, I mean, it's really the American way, that they get the recognition and the identity that comes with it. It's amazing what a motivator identity is, the ability to put your name on a coffee, that to get some personal recognition for hard work that you do. And so, and many of the coffees that we buy are at least double the price of what a fair trade coffee would cost. These are coffees that people can, other companies compete over, and that it takes some considerable effort to source.
We're talking with Barry Levine from Willoughby's in New Haven. He's at the Yale Studios today. David Griswold's on the line with us from Portland and from Sustainable Harvest. You can join the conversation 860-275-7266. Let's go to Ruben in Hartford. Hi, Ruben. You're on Where We Live.
Hey, how you doing? I'm calling because one of my questions is about the fair trade and the smaller, poorer co-ops, like co-ops in Ethiopia. Now, I've studied in the past that some of those co-ops in some of these fair trade agreements are shut out when, you know, dealing in a fair price for their coffee. And many times a lot of those countries, poor countries in Africa, end up getting shut out or given a much lower sum for all the hard work they have to put in and all the land that they have to use just to even get enough to bring in schools to their systems and everything like that. I'd like to know what is being done for some of these countries, because I support more Ethiopian coffee myself because I know this, and I know that my money will go to helping some of those people.
David,
I'll take my comments off the air.
Hey, Ruben, thank you very much for your phone call. David Griswold, you want to pick up on Ruben's question?
Yeah, sure. I think what he says is accurate, that I think he was referring to that sometimes the cost of fair trade and other seals can be prohibitive for groups. And I, think it, you do have to be a certain size in some cases. You can't be a single farmer and pay the fair trade annual fees and things like that because they're larger. I think in the particular case of Ethiopia, which is a country where we work, the government has organized the cooperatives. There are sub-co-ops, but they're organized in the three main unions, and the Yirga Chefe and Tadama and Oromia being the three main unions. Those have about 48 to 50,000 growers in each union, so they're very large, and they're fair trade certified. But it's the sub-co-ops, the prime below that, some of those may get lost. And I think in terms of, I'm not sure if they're all signed up for fair trade. I think that what he points to is just a general question that there's a need for accessibility for certifications at all levels and to make sure that the farmers don't have to pay too much to be part of these certification schemes. And I think everybody in the coffee industry wants to see that happen. So I think his question is exactly in the right direction.
Peter in Stamford. Hi, Peter. You're on Where We Live. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a question about a few things. Shade-grown coffee I've heard about, and I wonder, is that a more eco-friendly coffee? And also, how do you know if you're getting shade-grown or a fair trade coffee? If you go into a Starbucks or one of their rivals, Dunkin' Donuts, how do you, in the store, how do you know that it's either fair trade certified? Is there a labeling system, or and also the shade grown coffee?
Well, let's try to ask our Barry Levine. Maybe you can pick up on Peter's question.
Yes, I can answer it on both counts. For fair trade, there is a label. Fair trade is governed by in the U.S. by the certifier is called Transfer USA, and they have a seal that should be affixed to every fair trade product. Fair trade doesn't just certify coffee; they also certify tea, bananas, and some other fruits. And as far as his other aspect, shade grown is both certified and non-certified. It's a growing practice almost exclusively throughout all of Central America. In many parts in the world, it's a good thing to grow coffee in the shade because it makes coffee grow slower. And it also, of course, provides biodiversity that we discussed previously. It's canopy for a lot of birds and insects and other animals. But it's primarily there to function as a way to slow the growth of coffee, which helps to concentrate its sweetness and its character. When coffee is being produced strictly for abundance, it can be grown in full sun. This is a widely done practice in Brazil, and it has been done extensively in parts of Africa and in Colombia. But the general practice of quality coffee is to have shade.
And that's what's interesting about this product that's maybe different from a lot of other products in the world is that the better tasting product, the one you might enjoy more, you might pay a little bit more for, is probably also going to be the one that's a little bit more sustainable and a little bit more eco-friendly in a lot of cases. I have to, before I let David Griswold go from Sustainable Harvest out in Portland, our last two callers have kind of hinted at something, questions about what should I buy. One caller says, I want to support Ethiopian farmers. Somebody else says, I really want to drink shade-grown coffee. David Griswold, is there some sort of a key that you can point to and say, you know, if you want to make a difference, buy this kind of coffee or that kind of coffee?
Well, I think when you look at organic coffee and shade-grown coffee and coffee's fair trade, rainforest lines, coffees that have been vetted by some of these certification systems, that's a good first step. But again, as Barry was mentioning, it's really about the quality. So the most important thing you can do is see if these roasters have developed a relationship. Are they telling a story on the package? Can you ask the barista behind the counter about where the coffee came from? More and more in the United States, roasters are having direct relationship coffees, and this is something we support and love to see, because the more information that consumers ask about the coffee, the sense that the growers will actually know who they're selling to, the quality is improving, and I think that's what you look for. Simply looking for a seal and saying, okay, it's going to be good enough, is not enough. That was perhaps something that was okay 10 years ago, but now I think people should start looking for a more complete story. So asking these questions is really on the right road. They now now see what it tastes like, and do you want to buy it again?
I quickly want to go to Julie in Waterbury. Hi, Julie. You're on Where We Live.
Hi.
Hi.
I am calling to share my experience with coffee in the Dominican Republic.
Yeah.
I remember seeing my grandmother roast the coffee outside, like somebody was explaining before, how they put a big tarp and the coffee was roasted outside. And how different it is that we drink espresso coffee over there as regular coffee, whereas here, coffee is drank as is more. The coffee that you drink is more watery in a consistency, very watery.
Julie, explain what the coffee tastes like. If you're having that coffee that you can actually see being dried by your grandmother and everything else, what does it taste like? How is it different than, you know, the watered-down cup that you might get here in Connecticut?
Well, it's a stronger consistency, and just it's a little bitter, and we actually don't mind the bitterness. Maybe it's not roasted right, like the way they say over here, there's a little bitterness, but it's also like a stronger flavor. You don't taste so much the roast, the way they roast it, but you taste more of the fruit itself. It's more fruity.
Julie, one last question for you. You know, obviously you can't recreate that same taste around here, or maybe you can. Do you have a favorite coffee place, someplace you get your coffee?
I just get it at home.
Yeah?
Yes.
And you make your own. Make it strong,
yeah,
huh?
I make it in those little containers, those Dominican ones that are like, that you make your own, like, espresso at home. But not a fancy machine, but a stainless steel one.
I know the ones you're talking about, and it makes pretty good coffee. I appreciate your phone call, Julie. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
And you can join us, too, at 860-275-7266. You can share your coffee stories. I want to thank David Griswold from Sustainable Harvest out in Portland, Oregon. They're a coffee importing social enterprise. They try to improve the livelihoods of small farmers around the world. David, thank you very much for being here. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We're going to continue our conversation with Barry Levine from Willoughby's. We'd like to hear from you, 860-275-7266. We'll also be talking about Blue State Coffee. Yeah, Blue State Coffee is a local company with stores in Connecticut and Rhode Island that donates sales to local progressive causes. Is coffee a progressive cause? 860-275-7266. This is where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's one of the most heavily traveled sections of the busiest road in America. It seems our stretch of I-95 through Connecticut is always full of traffic and construction. We hate it, but it's an unavoidable part of our lives. Coming up for the next Where We Live is a companion to the NPR series, The Road Most Traveled. We'll look at the history, the folklore, and the future of just the terrible I-95. Join the conversation Where We Live on air and online at WNPR.org. Keyword where. Today we're talking about coffee. Do you drink it? Do you have a favorite coffee shop? Do you consider yourself an informed consumer? 860-275-7266. We're talking about it because of a new exhibit at the Peabody Museum. It's in New Haven at Yale. It's called Coffee, the World in Your Cup. One of the people behind it is Barry Levine. His store Willoughby's, of course, has been there for years and years selling coffee and tea. You can join us, 860-275-7266. We want to bring in first, though, his name is Drew Rubin. And Drew is the co-owner of Blue State Coffee. It's a local coffee company with stores in Connecticut and Rhode Island. They donate 5% of their sales to local progressive causes. And Drew, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So how did you get involved in this and in linking these two things? We talked about coffee as a revolutionary product earlier on. Is it a political product as well?
I absolutely think so. And you've heard already from others in the business how along the supply chain, you know, from the farm to the roaster, there are a lot of decisions you have to make in terms of, you know, environmental consciousness and, you know, environmental sustainability. And also ethics, you know, how are you treating the workers? And to my mind, those are political decisions.
So those are political decisions. So you've decided to take it the whole way. You call it Blue State Coffee, and you're actually donating to progressive causes. Tell us more about that.
Sure. It's sort of a thought experiment. You know, what does a business look like if it incorporates Blue State values into its business practices? By that, I mean a commitment to social justice and environmental sustainability. So when a customer makes a purchase at Blue State Coffee, and we have stores in New Haven on Wall Street and York Street, they get a token, and with that token they can vote for one of four nonprofit organizations in New Haven. And we donate at the end of every quarter 5% of our sales exactly according to the results of those votes. And so far we've donated almost $200,000.
Now, coffee is, as we've said, pretty ubiquitous. Everyone seems to drink it. It's not really just a Blue State or progressive phenomenon. So do you ever find yourself talking with customers who really like your coffee but hate your politics?
You know, every now and then that's certainly the case. But what I've found is that those who are, you know, self-described as liberal or progressive love the business model. And even those who aren't can sometimes appreciate it, because at the end of the day, what we're doing is supporting, you know, local nonprofit organizations that do so much with so little.
Barry Levine, maybe we can pick up on this. We touched on this earlier, this idea that sometimes the most sustainable coffee, the coffee that has grown the best, that maybe has the best outcome for the farmers, also is the coffee that tastes the best. Is this really the market at work, Barry, in some ways, where if you pay a little bit more for a good cup of coffee that tastes good and it's roasted locally, it's actually going to both taste better and be better for the environment and everyone along the line?
Well, we'd like to think so. Certainly, I think in our own experience, we find that the work that gets done when it's done at a high level does embrace all of those ideologies. There are many models for how one sells coffee, and Willoughby's particular model is a quality-driven one. We do get down and see farms firsthand. We see the way the sustainability that is embraced by various growers. We see models such as new micro mills that are coming online that reduce water use and enable local farmers to have their name in the game as well, and to achieve direct improvement in their lives. I have to say too that when we travel, I often see some real interest in sustainability and longevity within the countries of origin. I mean, often in the U.S., we talk about it a lot, but when you actually get to places where coffee is grown, you really get a sense of multi-generational vision, where somebody today is really interested in what their children and their grandchildren are going to inherit from them in the way of their business and their land and their lifestyle. And, we come across this all the time.
Yeah, I want to get to the phones again, and because our callers are coffee drinkers, I'm sure we can do it very, very quickly and efficiently. Patricia is on the line. Go ahead, Patricia. You're on Where We Live.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I love espresso, and I love it the way it's made in Italy, but I can't find the right roast, so I go all the way into New York to Puerto Rico and get French Italian. But I don't know if it's something that is a fair trade or not, and I've never really asked them that question. Is there a place where one can get that? Because I do believe in fair trade.
You believe in fair trade, and you want to get this certain coffee taster. Drew Rubin, what do you tell Patricia?
I would tell Patricia to come by Blue State and ask for an espresso, and we can play with the machine and arrive at an espresso that's to her liking. It might be a ristretto, which might be a bit more bitter, sort of the Italian style. And I know what you're going through, Patricia, because I was in Rome last year and had sort of the same experience.
Yes.
But come on in, we can talk about it.
Thank you. Where are you?
We're on Wall Street and York Streets in New Haven, Connecticut.
Okay, thank you.
I'm shocked that that's your answer, Drew. hey,
yeah,
Barry.
That was shocking.
Barry, I'll bet you have the same answer, don't you?
Yeah, well, very similar. Yes, we'd like to come down to Willoughby's. We have two stores in New Haven as well, on Church and Grove, and also in the Yale Architecture Building, which is on York and Chapel.
Maybe we'll get some callers who can find some good coffee places in the state that aren't in New Haven. They all seem to be concentrated. They're Rankin and Hartford. Go ahead, Rankin. You're on Where We Live.
Oh, hi, John. My name is Doug. How you doing?
Oh, hi. Go ahead.
I was just first of all, it's a painful subject for me today because I haven't had my first cup of coffee.
Oh man, you got to get going. So what's on
your
mind?
I'll make a brief call. I just wanted to say that we've sort of, for my wife and I, it's been a realization as we've been going to farmers markets much more and finding that we like to personalize our coffee choices as well. So we stumbled upon an internet broker of it called Dean's Beans in Orange, Massachusetts, and we've been buying our coffee online and we've been learning the stories of all the growers who he goes to see and meet and so forth, and it sounds just like what they're doing at Blue State and Willoughby's and so forth. But it's amazing once you open your eyes to the connection between the coffee growers and your cup of coffee. It's a pretty dynamic process once you sort of unravel it.
Hey, thanks very much for your phone call, and go get that cup, okay?
I will, thanks.
Okay, go ahead quickly, Barry.
No, I was just going to say mail order is a big piece of our business as well. We sell coffee to people all over the U.S. in every state.
Yeah, and that's one of the things. People can get their favorite coffee sort of shipped to them. Garth is in North Haven. Hi, Garth. You're on Where We Live.
Hi.
Hi, what's up?
I have a story to share in case people have time. I was visiting the Kona coast of Hawaii a few years ago. We were visiting Sacred Grounds Coffee Farm, and Bill and Jane had brewed us a fresh cup of coffee that they dealt with the papers and everything else. It was delightful, especially with the mac nut freshly roasted. I came back to Indianapolis, where I live, and I went to a farmer's market where there was a local roaster. And the local roaster was trying to expound upon all the things that he had done about bringing coffees from all over the world. And when I asked him the simple question of how he roasts his beans, whether it's by time or by crack, he wasn't able to answer it. So for the connoisseurs in the audience, when you go to a local roaster, you want to make sure that they know what they're doing instead of just passing the beans on. Mm. It makes a huge difference.
Well, Garth, thank you very much for the story. I also have to say this gets to something that's been a thread through this conversation, and certainly something I've felt is that whenever I'm traveling, if I was on the coast of Hawaii, I'd probably drink some Kona there, and I'd find it amazing because of the place where I am, not just the coffee that I'm drinking. The best cup of coffee I ever had was overlooking the Mediterranean in Collioure, France. Well, I think it has an awful lot to do with where I was, and I think this is something that our coffee experts can agree with, too. Drew, Barry, as you travel around the world, you probably get a chance to see a lot of places and have some great cups of coffee that are, let's just say, influenced by the surroundings.
Absolutely. The vacation experience is a big part of it. Of course, we have a great cup of coffee when we're on the Kona coast or when we're in Italy, and the memories of our coffee when we were growing up in the Dominican Republic, because there's an association between the coffee and the place.
I want to get to Maria in Farmington. Quickly, Maria, we're running low on time on Where We Live.
Hi, yeah. Actually, I went to Colombia, and I actually went to a coffee farm. And I found that we own a coffee farm.
who is you? You own a coffee farm?
Yes, me and my husband.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, he's from Colombia, and he always debates that the best coffee's from Colombia, and I always tell him the best coffee's from Turkey.
Yeah. So hold it. You found out you own a coffee farm. What are you doing with it? Are you learning the business?
Well, no. Actually, I don't know exactly what they do with it. I don't even know if they sell it to large companies or anything, but I mean, I was just surprised that he told us we own a coffee farm.
Well, you'll have to check back in with us and let us know how that's going, Maria. That sounds pretty interesting. It sounds like a good deal. I appreciate your phone call.
Yeah, thank you.
And because we're low on time, if you have any other coffee stories to share, please email us wherewelive@wnpr.org because we would love to continue the conversation online. I want to thank Drew Rubin. He's the co-owner of Blue State Coffee. They give to local progressive causes. They've got some stores in New Haven. Thank you very much, Drew, for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks also to Barry Levine, a co-founder of the local specialty coffee store Willoughby's, which you know real well. It's in New Haven. They've been there since 1985 selling coffee and tea. They're part of this new exhibit at the Peabody Museum. It's been going for a while there, actually, now at Yale. It's called Coffee, the World in Your Cup. Barry, thanks so much for sharing some time with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
Coming up tomorrow, we'll be heading down toward New Haven, at least metaphorically speaking. We'll be going along one of the heaviest traveled roads in the entire United States. It's I-95. We hate it, we love it, but it's an unavoidable part of our lives. We're tying into the NPR series, The Road Most Traveled, looking at the history, the folklore, and the future of I-95. I hope you can join us. Thanks today to Andrew Houston and Ali Warshawski. Katie Tolarski is the senior producer. Josie Holtzman is the producer of Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski.